so call the meeting order. Did everybody get a chance to review the March 20th meeting minutes? And if so, was there a motion to approve?
So.
Okay. I'm sorry, who moved and who seconded? Bob and Remy? Thank you.
Okay, any discussion? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, so maybe we've got some home with us. So is Amy here?
She's not here,
she may,
no.
She may be,
but.
The meeting's commencing a little bit. Do you know if Amy's coming back?
Do you know Joan?
Huh?
Do you know if Amy will be here?
Amy.
From Council Commission of Aging?
I don't know. Oh, okay. I don't know. I did get to the commission meeting this afternoon, so I didn't see her.
We got one. Public attendance?
This is.
Hi.
This is Billy.
This is Melanie's. Oh, okay. I think that's not your.
It's my chauffeur back there.
Your chauffeur. Okay. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you for your bringing along.
You're public. Okay. And so we don't have Amy here and couldn't have Amy. And then we can move on to our department updates.
There's a lot. I don't know. You didn't get this whole packet, did you?
Yes.
I'm not going to go through all this stuff because some of it doesn't even affect us. It was a short legislative session. I think I'm just going to give you a couple of highlights. And I think the biggest highlight, at least from my perspective, I was happy about was medication take back. House Bill 1047 passed. And actually was signed into a law by the governor as well. Several counties had passed ordinances that basically, well, let me step back. Previously, around medication take back, if you had old medications in your medicine cabinet and you wanted to get rid of them, there was really there was a limited amount of places where you could take it. And one of the reasons for encouraging people to clean out their medicine cabinets is a lot of folks have, for, among other things, old pain medications in their medicine cabinets. And that's a great way to get, and it's been shown that folks, including kids, can get into the medicine cabinets and use some of the opioids that are in there, some of the controlled drugs. It's a way for that to get into circulation. So in the past, there were, there were a couple of ways that there were some drug take back days that people could participate in. You could bring it to the sheriff's office, some of the law enforcement offices, but there wasn't any like really a regular, easy way, routine way to be able to dispose of medications. So several counties passed an ordinance that basically had the drug companies for there would be an assessment on prescription medications and people bought them a few cents per prescription, and that would fund countywide drug take back programs that would have lock boxes in pharmacies and hospitals where people during business hours and even on weekends could just deposit their unused medications, and the drug companies paid for that. Pharmaceutical companies didn't like it because they were obviously paying for it and they operated it as well. And for at least a couple of sessions, we were able to oppose that at the state level. Finally, everything aligned and we were able to pass a state drug take back program. So it'll be throughout the state. We were looking at maybe doing one in Clark County and getting a board to pass it, but it won't be necessary anymore because the statewide program passed. So that was. So now people have a lot of great places where they can take their medications and dispose of them safely. Instead of having them flushed down the toilet and getting into the waste stream, they will be incinerated appropriately. So I don't know if anybody guess.
Speaking of that, I had this information with regards to a take-back program at the end of this month on the 28th. I belong to Kaiser, and Kaiser distributed these to people. There's Peace Health, Kaiser, Battleground Police Department, Washougal Silver Star Search and Research, and Skamania County Sheriff's Office. are some of the places you could take this. Also, at Kaiser, they had this bag. You can just put them in this bag and mail them, and they'll take it. So that was all at Kaiser. I don't know.
Yeah, well, once this is in place, you'll be able to go every day.
Yeah.
As long as the pharmacies are open and the hospitals are open, and there's somebody in the line of sight, you'll be able to dispose of them every day.
Out at the East Precinct, they have a, you can bring them there anytime, 24 hours a day. You know, they have bags, and they have a little mailbox that you put them in. And it's, you know, it's because it's a police station. I don't know if the downtown station has one, but the East Precinct does that on their plane.
That's
it's very
great.
Easy. You know, if you can't get to a take back day.
Right. Right. Well, there'll be many, many more places where people can take their medications. And that includes over the counter as well. And then there was one other bill. There was this issue about mobile food units, and it was a concern that it would be exempt from state board of health or local health jurisdictions like ours from our requirements. And actually, that was worked out, and there was a solution to that, I believe. As long as they meet the requirements of what restaurants are required to go through, this will all work out. And Paul, you may know more about this than I do, but it was House Bill 2016.
Yeah, it's pretty much as you said right there. That's basically it. Yeah.
Are you talking about the food carts? Is that what a mobile?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The ones with the wheels.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The move.
So actually, it ended up being supported by the local. Basically, the bill that finally passed preserves local health authority to regulate these in terms of safety. So that worked out really well. Okay. And we may end up seeing a lot more mobile food units around. Mm-hmm. I was just going to go over those two. There was a lot of other stuff, but the ones that impact us the most, I don't know if anybody on Janice, Jeff, Roxanne, if you have anything to add.
Just to be able to read this appropriately, I think it's helpful, but obviously it's a lot of information, is on the back kind of chart, the physician support neutral line, if it doesn't have anything, if it's not been, the bill hasn't been proposed yet, the second page, the half and the last page of it.
It says delivered to governor, that means it got out of the legislature and the governor could sign it. So you can see the first on page 9 of 14, the one that I just told you about, 1047, that was a drug take back bill. That passed out of both the House and the Senate.
Okay.
And that's why it was delivered to the governor for signature.
Okay, I see. Okay, that's good.
If it didn't get there, it died in some sort of committee. So there's different names of the committees, like rules.
So if it says dead, it was
connected,
right. Done. Yeah. And then the other bills, so that's more new.
So you can see on page 10 of 14, the mobile food units, in the middle of the page, you can see it says delivered to governor.
Okay.
So that's the one I just, so I didn't want to go belabor this conversation with a whole bunch of bills that didn't make it out.
Yeah, no, I think that this was helpful, and I think that, you know, having the information, but then you going through the ones that are more, you know, active, obviously, is helpful. Thank you.
And sometimes these bills, even though they say dead, they come back, they're like zombie bills. They come back to life, you'll see them again.
I know, I just saw Paul Hurst at the Healthy Living Collaborative last week, and he's going to continue to bird dog this 1921 bill.
Yeah. Well, that will be on the agenda for the next session. I mean, part of the problem with this session, it was a short session, so it's hard to, you know, stuff gets hurried along, but I think we'll probably see Tobacco 21 on the agenda for next legislative session. One of the bills around opioids that would increase access to medication-assisted treatment and prevention, that didn't make it out either, otherwise we would mention more about that.
Strategic plan, and this will lead into accreditation. So I'm just going to give you guys a you all, and I'll say about how very into that is that. And esteemed members of the FAC committee, I'm going to be giving you an update on my strategic plan, just very briefly, and then we'll talk a little bit about accreditation and where we are there. The strategic plan, you should all have a two-pager front and back in your packet. We'll be sharing a little bit more about this in more depth at an upcoming meeting, so this is just going to be a high-level overview, so if you have a copy of it and you know what we're working towards. It's the strategic plan, if you all may notice, is 2018 to 2025. That's an odd kind of a timing, but the reason we did that is that we're moving from a two-year to a five-year strategic plan, and we also wanted to align this with our accreditation. Our accreditation happens every 5 years. We have to have an updated strategic plan every 5 years. So this is really in order to just align us with that accreditation process. From here on out, the next plan you'll see is 2025 to 2030. So there'll be five-year plans going on forward. But we hadn't updated it in a while, and so that's why we went ahead and we just put we updated it for this year, and that will take us into accreditation. When we developed this strategic plan, we took our old strategic plan, and then we worked with our management group to update the mission, vision, and values, and also the priorities and goals that are on the next page. There wasn't a whole lot of changes on our mission, vision, and values from before, but we did update the last bullet point on the first page, which is protecting the natural environment. While we had that implied in there, it wasn't called out specifically. And we did feel like, especially with what our environmental public health team does, we wanted to make sure that it was called out in a more broadly. So we added this bullet point, which says, we recognize the natural environment is our life support system. Protecting the soil, water, and air is critical to the health and resiliency of our community. So that was added this year. And then if you flip it over, we also put together a list of priorities and goals. And what we're doing here is we're working with, not only did we work with our management group to put together these priorities and goals, but then our management group is developing work plans that will fall under the strategic plan. So their work plans are going to align with all these priorities and goals that we have. Now, not every program work plan will hit every one of these priorities, but through the breadth of our department, each one of these priorities and goals will be hit with some of the work that we do. They're developing their work plans that will be appendices to this document, and that's what we'll share with you at an upcoming meeting when we get it finished. So we're in the process of doing that. The other thing that we're going to be doing is that from there, each of our work plans will have measures, and we will be pulling some measures out to have a higher level dashboard, which will be our sort of our annual reporting. And we're working on that as well. So we'll be sharing with you what that dashboard looks like at that time as well. We're going to be reviewing this also at the end of every year with our management team to make sure, number one, that there's no adjustments that need to be made, but also to update our work plans. That's okay. So I'm not actually going to go over in great detail what this is, but I didn't know if any of you had a chance to review or had any questions about the process or about the plan itself. Or does it look good? Does it look like we missed anything? Yeah, and we're really excited because, to be honest with you, up to now, our strategic plan has been one of those documents that you put together and you put it on a poster and you hang it on a wall. It's not that we weren't doing the work associated with the strategic plan, but we weren't really using it as a living document to help guide our work. And this is really designed, this whole process is really designed to really make this the document that's guiding our work. And we put a process in place so that we can really make sure that we are continue to be in alignment with that strategic plan. Part of what we did too is when we were working on the strategic plan, we looked at the community health strategist and the foundational public health services and the requirements for that as well. So that all of that stuff was really involved in developing this plan and updating the plan. So anyway, more to come on this. This was also a requirement, as I mentioned earlier, for our accreditation. So I'll start talking about accreditation now, too, unless there's any questions. You all know we're going through accreditation, which is really important for us, not only to make sure that we are our processes and are in place and we can demonstrate that, but that also this is going to be very helpful for us in the future, we believe, for ongoing funding. We certainly know that there's a big push on with the CDC and also the Departments of Health around the nation for not only the Departments of Health, the state Departments of Health, but also the local health jurisdictions to be accredited. So we're excited to be involved in this process, although it is really a, it's quite the process, let me tell you. And basically what we're doing with regard to accreditation is we're going through, and I think you've had some background in this already, we've given you some updates, but we're on track for 2019 to become accredited. We went ahead and we put our application in the beginning of this year, and that started the clock ticking. We're currently working on several different work plans that will fall underneath that are associated with our strategic plan as well, but are required for accreditation. One of those is actually a workforce development plan, a quality improvement plan, an emergency operations plan, and a performance and organizational branding strategy. All those are required for accreditation in addition to our strategic plan and our community health needs assessment and our community health improvement plan. All those things that we're doing are required for accreditation. So we're working diligently on those right now. And we're, in addition to developing these plans, we're identifying and cataloging all the documents that demonstrate alignment with those accreditation requirements. So there's a, I'm thinking 100 and something areas that we're putting documents together for. So it's pretty expensive. We expect this process, putting together all the documents, to be done by fall. And that will be followed by an initial review by the Public Health Accreditation Board, or FAB. They'll be coming on site, and they're going to be reviewing. Yes, you have a question?
I was just wondering, what will it mean to be accredited?
What it will mean to be accredited is that we are a health department that is aligned with all of the public health core competencies, as well as the foundational public health services that that all public health departments are required to do. And we can actually demonstrate the quality through this process. We're demonstrating quality and quality improvement in all the processes that we have in place. So basically what it does is it demonstrates quality and that we're hitting, you know, all of those earmarks for that health departments are required to be focused on.
The other thing that it's going to do, if I can add something, some states are actually, believe it or not, requiring health departments to be accredited, but when you apply for grants, it'll put us in much better competitive position for grant funding as well.
Which is great.
Oh, absolutely. Free money.
So it'll be worth the pain, hopefully. Once we have our FAB folks that come on site, they're going to do an initial review, and they're going to take a look at our documentation, and then they're going to give us a, hey, you know, there's some gaps here, there's some other things that we might need. So we'll have an opportunity to, you know, for them to do sort of a first review in advance of when we expect the formal process would be happening probably at the beginning of next year, and then accreditation will happen sometime after that. They do these reviews every quarter, so we have to align with what their process is. So we do expect that they will come in sometime after fall this year and do their initial review. It could be pushed into next year, but we're hoping that it would be in the fall.
So that first review is done on site? It's not,
yeah.
We don't submit documents to them?
Yeah. So. Yeah, and there's a whole process of submitting documentation and all of that stuff, but they do come out and do a review, and they'll do interviews with all of us. Especially with Alan, they'll make sure that he knows all these processes that are going on. So he's been very, very involved in this accreditation process. They'll be talking to each one of the domain leads. There's, I think, 10 or 12 domains, and they'll be talking to each one of the domain leads as well. So it's quite the process.
So the domains that you made, sound very similar to the domains that are assessed in college.
Right.
What kind of people will be doing accreditation evaluation. What are their backgrounds and knowledge?
Are you talking about the site visitors? Mm-hmm.
They are a variety of different people. All of them are public health professionals, mm-hmm. but they're at all different levels. Mm-hmm. Some have been department directors, some have been at the state level, some have been associated with like the National Association of City and County Health Officials, so NHO. There's a variety of folks that are on it now, but all of them are public health professionals. We also have several on the board right now that were actually accreditation coordinators themselves, mm-hmm. so they're very, very familiar with the process.
So they're employees of FAB, or are they working in the field and then are convened for the site visit?
You know, that I don't know. I think
I can answer that.
Oh, you can, good.
Yeah, so they're contracted by FAB, and I believe they actually volunteer for FAB, but they, you know, their travel is paid for. But many of them are currently working as some of them are maybe academics, some of them are health department, you know, health officials at other state and local health departments. Some of them retired, but were former.
Yeah. Yeah.
Will you be the first ones in Washington, or do you have some buddies that already did this?
Yeah, there's. And I kept Jim. Do you remember
State of Washington has Spokane is accredited, yeah. And I think Tacoma Pierce might be.
Yeah, Tacoma Pierce. Yeah.
So there's not many then.
Not many.
No, there's 3,000 health departments, 2,800 health departments in the United States, and several hundred are accredited.
Wow.
And it's difficult. This is a resource-intensive kind of a thing, and so especially some of the smaller health departments, it's really hard for them. One of the things we are doing is we're working with NHO right now to actually develop a toolkit, especially around the workforce development plan, but we're helping them as well to take a look at this accreditation process and put together some toolkits that will help people, especially the smaller jurisdictions, to really get through this. So.
Is there a cycle where they'll do a re-accreditation every 3 years?
Every 5 years. Yep. So we get to do this again.
And it's a cost associated with it. Isn't there a cost associated with it as well?
Yes, there is. Do you remember, Janice? I'm sorry, I keep asking you.
No, it's fine. I think it's like in the 16,000.
I think it went up, yeah, a little bit.
And depends on the size of your office.
Yes, exactly. It depends on the size.
So some counties might have struggled with the finances of it.
Or their boards don't support it. I mean, we have
right.
To.
Right. Yes. And there is a cost to re-accredit as well, which recently changed too. So I don't know, but it's less than the initial.
I have one other just quick question.
Yeah, sure.
We're thinking about doing it for our police department. I can't remember if Battleground's done it before. But I know sometimes when you go through an accreditation, I've done it for some different, not this scope. You learn some things. You learn some best practices, and you kind of change things up a little bit. Has that been your experience in this process?
Yeah.
So it's value added, even just going through the process,
yes.
To advance your organization into more and more best practices.
Right.
Cool. Very good.
And that is actually what we found. We have found a lot of the things associated with accreditation that we're doing, but we're not really documenting very well. So there's a gap. But then there's some other things that we just have not done. A great example is the workforce development plan. We have a workforce development process, but we don't have a whole plan in place. We don't have the training in place, that sort of thing. And so that's we're really looking at doing, you know, surveys. Eventually we'll be doing some focus groups into the coming years around really that succession planning and workforce development, which is going to be really critical. So it has really helped us in to look at not only what we've got in place right now, but how we document it, how we tell our story, where are those gaps, and where do we need to really work on those gaps. And so it's been a good process so far. Although difficult, I mean, it is very resource intensive, so.
It's awesome.
So there'll be more. We'll be updating you all on how we're doing there as time goes on. We'll have our accreditation coordinator, Chris Goodwin, and our program assistant, Sharina Walker, come back in a future meeting and give you an update about where we're going. Okay. Okay. Any other questions? Super duper. Thank you.
Community Health Award. So this is April is Public Health Month, and in honor of Public Health Month, we're at the next Board of Health meeting, we will be distributing the community health awards, both to an individual and an organization that has really done above and beyond to improve the health of folks who live in Clark County. So we had a good number of really outstanding nominations. This year we've had 5 organizations. I'm not going to read them all because I think they're in your packet. I don't think you want me to read to you. There's 5 individuals listed here, but we really had 6 originally, and Dr. Remy Usin was one of the 6 who withdrew his nomination. I hope it's okay that I'm mentioning this. It was well deserved, but he has received it before. So, but I mean, I was suggesting we may want to give him one in perpetuity for all that he does. But he's been doing that obviously for a long time. But we had 5 really outstanding individual and 6, and then 5 outstanding organizational ones. A group of FAC members, as well as our folks, our staff from our communications action team, we're known as CAT, actually selected the winners. We're not going to announce them here because we don't want to upstage the Board of Health and get that information out there before the Board of Health meeting. So anyway, that's the plan. So next Wednesday at 8:30, the Board of Health meetings are no longer televised. So if you guys can be there, anybody can be there, it would be great.
Next Wednesday at what time?
8:30 at the Public Service Building, Public Service Center, 6th floor, in the counselor's hearing room.
How come we're not televised?
That's a really good question. So it was funding issue. There was a cost to doing it. I can't remember the cost, but it was considerable. And we actually took a look at the number of people who viewed them because they're streamed on CBTV, and you can see them from the website. The average number of viewers was 20 for each of our Board of Health meetings. So, and I would suspect that some of those are staff or FAC members or folks like that. So it wasn't really broadly viewed in the community anyway. So it didn't seem to be that tragic that they're not televised anymore. So anyway, but it was a funding issue. It was just, that's my report.
Okay. I was going to have an executive committee meeting before the regular meeting, and we, if you guys remember, we did have two amendments to the bylaws, one that will need a motion, and one that we are proposing some changes in writing, and then we will vote if everybody likes it, we will put it into writing and vote on it at the next member meeting. The first is in our packet with section 3 of, I assume this is Article 5, or Article 3, but we don't see the 3. It's section 3, and we're just changing it to read, members who are unable to attend the meeting shall notify the public health administrative assistant beforehand. Members who have 3 unexcused absences per calendar year, including committee meetings if assigned, may constitute a cause to recommend replacement to the Board of Health. And again, that was unexcused, so you know, conversations about who's going to be here and who's not going to be here was the big change. Is there a motion to approve the amended bylaws?
Move.
Second. Who moved? I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Remy.
Thank you. And Jones.
And is there discussion on any? Does anybody have any questions or like to discuss it? Okay. All right. All in favor of the new bylaws?
Aye.
Aye.
And then the second one, and we talked about this at the last meeting, was what constitutes a majority and quorum, and there was some discussion on that, and we kind of talked it over again. And so this is kind of what we came to. It is in here. It's section 3 on the opposite page, and basically it's The presence of a majority of the members of the council shall constitute a quorum. So basically, majority of the members, there's 20, generally 20 council members. The vote of a majority of the members of the council present at any meeting which a quorum is present shall be the act of the council. The vote of a majority. So it's just majority vote. And then if quorum of the matter is not present at a meeting, a vote by email shall be considered on approval of the executive. So I don't think we need a vote, but is there any discussion or any changes that people would like?
So we have 20 members or 21 members?
20.
20. So if we have 11 people, that constitutes a quorum. Correct. Unless there's a vacant, we have a vacant position, then it would be less. Because, you know, right. If we have two members, two vacant positions, then it would be 10.
Correct. And then the majority of those 11, so if there's only 11 people here, it would have to be, majority would rule. If we could vote, if there was 11.
Yeah.
So, pretty simple. Hopefully we can remember it. I'm giggling.
What did it say before?
Two-thirds.
Oh, well, we've moved it to a majority versus two-thirds.
Long story short is it actually didn't say anything.
Right.
Okay.
So there wasn't anything in our bylaws.
Okay, it's a new section now.
So yes, so we're creating a new section about the quorum, which needs to be in there, in our opinion. And then it was only based on, we were being very careful. it was two-thirds, so we're making it a little bit broader and actually putting something in there.
And I think the two-thirds only applied to amendments to the bylaws.
Correct.
It wasn't about general council vote.
Correct.
Yep. Well, I think a majority is fine. We don't need a super majority or anything because we're not doing any kind of taxes or, you know, we're not.
Well, we did put something in there about email approval, which yeah. I think, you know, for some of the time dependent things would be good. But we did decide to not, we talked a little bit about remote calling in, and we kind of just decided to keep it as a pretty low majority, and so that people feel, people that are engaged, and we kind of lose that sometimes with remote. Okay.
I had one quick, yeah. It's just a minor little detail, just picking up on one thing Joan said. I know that for our council, when we have vacancies, it doesn't change the quorum.
Okay.
So you still got to have four council members. We have seven council members, mm-hmm. quorum is four. And so you've got to have four to conduct a meeting and take any action, and then it's a majority of the four. I don't know that we're so governed like by Robert's rules and all of those
right.
types of things, and so maybe the way that Joan described is exactly what this says, and it sounds pretty flexible. I just know you guys will be wondering about that at some point when there's vacancies, and you're like, oh no, can we do it? And don't know if it needs to be mm-hmm. further clarified.
Yes, yeah, so this is a majority of the members of the council, and the members, if there's vacancies, those would count as members.
Then they wouldn't be members.
Yeah, it doesn't say spot. It doesn't say positions, it says members.
Mm-hmm. So that's good. Okay. Makes sense.
So some of our meeting dates, meeting December 4th to cover.
So in the past we've done, like last year we've done, we did December 4th. To cover for November and December.
Yes, so that will be our new meeting date is December 4th. Is that
for this year.
For this year. Okay, so December 4th will have both of those dates, and we won't have a meeting in June.
We can go dark in June if everybody's okay with that.
We do have two vacancies, speaking with, you know, what David was saying, is that Kelly Espinosa is resigned, and correct, that's who was our legacy. And I cannot remember the tribal member's name.
Debbie.
So Debbie is not, it's not working out with her schedule, and so we are working. Alan has been.
So I can give you an update. Okay. Would you like to hear an update? So Debbie resigned. We have a new nomination from Cowlitz Indian Tribe, and I've got her CV, and we're putting a letter together to go to the to the Board of Health to appoint her. So hopefully, yeah, things moved along. We did get things moved along, and hopefully, I'm hoping that we can have her appointed before the time for the May FAT meeting.
Great. Great. And we're still working the legacy to refill Kelly placements.
So Kelly had an alternate that would attend when she was able to?
Well, she wasn't able to attend her.
Yeah, she was able to attend every other meeting, which was going to be changed.
Yeah.
All right, we're moving along, you guys. So we're going to have Jeff and Janice are going to do a presentation, and they're going to be the opposite of what is. We're going to do EPH fees first.
Yeah.
And budget.
Has this turned off what come back on?
The light's still on. So,
Now you've done it, Janice.
One of the key things that affects and drives our budget is our environmental public health fees. And so those are fees that we collect for services. So there have been times in the past when we have asked the Public Health Advisory Council to support us and help us through some of our budget requests and moving through the budget process. So what we wanted to do tonight was give you a high level overview to help you understand what goes into our fees, what the methodology is, so that if we come to you again for looking for some support, that you'll be able to, you'll understand some of the nuances of the fees. So, I am fairly new to EPH fees. That does not stop me from trying to tell everybody how to do it. Don't laugh too much, Alan.
What else is new? Yeah.
But Jeff Harbison is a longtime expert in fees, and so I have asked him to jump in and correct me or add context where needed. So this is, it's not very clear, is it? This is our environmental and public health programs. We have four main areas. We have our natural resource protection, solid waste, consumer protection, and office manager. And office manager oversees our support, a lot of the office support that helps with all the other areas of environmental public health. So we have in public health right now, we have two funds. We have, it's 4014, I think, and 1025. 4014 is solid waste. That's pretty new to us. The solid waste and environmental outreach program was previously in Department of Environmental Services. Before that, it was Public Works. They've been with us a couple years now, but it's been a change for us because they have their own fund, they're a different union, but I think we're getting to a place where we're very well integrated. But this is just to give you an idea of how their funding works. Recently, just as a reminder, recently the Public Health Advisory Council, you guys wrote a letter of support to increase our tipping fees. And there was a couple reasons for that. One was that the capital budget hasn't been signed yet, and so the funds for CPG, which is now the SWAFA, which is Local Solid Waste Financial Assistance. Yeah, I like the SWAFA better. So the funds for that were in the capital budget until that got signed. We didn't have any funding. Not only that, even if we get it, that funding has consistently been going down, and so we wanted to get an increase in tipping fees. Our tipping fees, as you may recall, were already quite a bit below other jurisdictions, comparable jurisdictions, and even with the tipping fee increase, it's still below. Since then, the capital budget has been signed, we have talked to our counselors, and they are supportive of us continuing to keep that fee increase. The reasons for that was, one, that during the six-month period that we didn't get any grant funding from CPG or LISWAPA, we had to cover that with our fund balance, and so we experienced a loss with that. The grant, the CPG or now the SWAPA grant, actually had an overall 60% reduction, which was a loss of 600,
$72,000. We had a site hazardous assessment grant that was cut completely. That's now been transitioned to Department of Ecology. But you can imagine there's still going to be some work that we'll need to be doing locally. And then also, just because we experience these decreases in the MACA funds, CPG, whatever you want to call it, has gone down, but we expect it will probably be a trend that it continues to be reduced. So these aren't the tipping fees that we'll be talking about you advocating for. You've already done that, and it was very helpful. But our focus really is going to, I just wanted to put that in context, but our focus is really going to be around our funding, our fees that support our consumer protection and natural resource programs. So those include drinking water, recreational water, solid and hazardous waste, on-site septic services permitting, on-site septic services operations and maintenance, food safety, and school and health safety. So this is currently how those programs are funded, big picture. The majority of it is funded by those fees. So since 2011, the fees are used, let's see, best way to describe this. The county general fund, by ordinance, the county counselors or commissioners at that time said, we're going to contribute county general fund to cover greater good services. So, what is greater good? So, anything that we do that protects the community as a whole, for example, complaint investigations. So, you know, a restaurant might pay for their inspections, and we go and make sure that the restaurant's safe and clean. But if there's a complaint, which we get, I just ate a burrito at 7-Eleven and I'm getting sick, we have to investigate that. But we're not going to make 7-Eleven pay for that, because chances are it wasn't the burrito, even though they probably shouldn't be getting a burrito at 7-Eleven. It's probably not the burrito that really made them sick, right? We get complaints about solid waste. You know, neighbors aren't getting garbage service anymore, and it's causing rodents to collect on my property. Just all kinds of things. And that's considered greater good. Prior to that, all that greater good work was covered under fees. It was considered cost of doing business or full cost recovery. So, Jeff has this crazy Excel setup that is like magical and very hard to understand. You put a bunch of numbers in it and you get an answer to what your fees should be. But I'm going to try and explain what's behind some of the magic. So one of the things our staff is, how we calculate fees has some to do with how long it takes to do the work. How long does it take to inspect a restaurant? And it makes a difference whether it's a restaurant that's like a bar that is only heating stuff up in the microwave, they're not really preparing, or it's a sushi house where maybe they're dealing with a lot of raw foods that are high risk for foodborne illness outbreak. So those estimates are pretty old now, and a lot has changed in environmental public health in terms of technology. So the staff for the last 6 months have been collecting what they call daily time activity. And that is basically how long does it take to get the work done. It's a pretty complex system. The codes, we have over 260 codes that go into the DTA, and there's any combination of how we can combination we put them together. The codes capture information as broad as program areas, such as food safety, to very specific information, such as the type of food establishment inspection. So all our restaurants are coded
differently depending on menu complexity and how much risk there is to the preparation of the food. And then it also captures how much time is spent actually doing like an inspection versus the support time. So we might go out and do an inspection, but then there's a lot of paperwork that happens behind that when they come back into the office or the office manager's staff does work to support that. So there's a lot of different data that they've been collecting on this. There's also time adjustment calculation because we know one FTE is not working 40 hours a week every week. We've got vacations, we've got sick leave, holidays, unit meetings, trainings, they have certifications they have to keep. So that's also then calculated. So we take all that time out to see how much time people actually have to do the work. And then I talked about a little bit that we have our customer support team, and that time also has to be covered. And a lot of that might be, well, Mark knows, he comes into the office regularly with his business, but we could have a professional that comes in that's pretty quick to answer some questions or process some paperwork. But then we also get people that are thinking about buying a property and have a lot of questions about how does the well work and how do I know if it's what I need and what kind of septic system will I need and what does that look like. So anyways, there's a lot of support work that goes with it. If you guys have questions or I'm saying something crazy, go ahead and stop me. So, or throw something at me. So, this is just to give you an idea of what our fee schedule looks like. So you can see in the upper right-hand column that a food plan review for a change of ownership is $175. So that fee is based on the amount of time it takes to do the plan review, field and office time, office support needed to process paperwork, and providing the applicant with needed information and education. So
that doesn't sound like enough.
I know, right?
It's plenty. No.
Oh. That was quick.
So a standard change of ownership, you would assume that the menu's not changing drastically, and it's not a lot of time. A new one, you're looking at $722, so it's much more.
Maybe, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can think about if it's Subway and they're just changing franchise owners, that's not a big deal. It still needs to be checked. But, you know, you think about what is it, the key? What's it called now?
Warehouse 23.
Yeah, it was a whole change in menu and layout and all kinds of stuff.
Or just down the street, the Kentucky Fried Chicken changed to a Mexican restaurant. Mm-hmm. That would be what you're talking about, right?
Yeah, that's a real change in what they're doing. And this was just to kind of show you, there's so many different variations of the type of work that they do. Even soil and site evaluation, there's four different fees there for different kinds of parts of the work that's being done. So this is when, I don't know if this is right at all. I asked for a lot of people to give me feedback, and I think people have been starting to ignore my emails. So Jeff, I could see you already grimaced when you saw it.
No, I grimaced because I forgot to email you.
Okay, so the first thing that happens is we enter the data into the spreadsheets, Jeff's magic spreadsheet. So we work with the managers, we work with the staff, we've been going through the DTA data. Now, in full transparency, we've only been collecting that DTA data for 6 months, and we entered it all, and the fees just went kind of crazy, which told us that the data wasn't really seasoned yet. We only had half of our summer months covered. So we decided to go back to the fee schedule that we have, but continue to collect this data. And so the next time we work on fees, we should have more reliable data to work with. But we also look at our fees. Do any of them not make sense anymore? Are there changes in the work that's being done? So we spend a lot of time collecting that.
And then Jeff developed some different cost recovery models and scenarios. So let's say that, what do we have now, Jeff? It's about 80% cost recovery?
It's 100% in a couple programs. It's 66 in drinking water, 83.5 in OSS permitting. So it's basically, it reflects back to when we had greater good. And it's basically, it's what the county councilors were okay approving for this the current budget cycle.
Right.
So it's, they're not, they're all the MAC on it.
So we might look at our fees and say, for example, workload has gone up, we need to add some staff. We do that, the fees are going to go up this much. If we have 100% cost recovery, meaning we don't get greater good out of the general fund anymore, this is what the counselors would have to approve for fees. But here's another model. If you said you wanted to cover 30% greater good, our 70% cost recovery would be these fees. And so we give them different scenarios to choose from. And it, Jeff does a really good job of balancing that. I can't describe it.
What is TAC?
Tech.
Oh,
what is that?
That's our technical advisory council. So all, I think most of our EPH programs, environmental public health programs, have some kind of like you guys are for the full department. So Mark, you're on a TAC, right?
Yeah, for the on-site. And
yeah, I'm on a TAC. Yeah.
And which one are you on?
TAC.
Food.
For food.
I think there's one for water. The water.
Yeah.
Do you guys want to talk a little bit, like just what the TACs do, or just?
Yeah, on site mainly. You know, we review policies, any concerns that we have. That's a good place to bring them up at. You know, questions on how to interpret rules. A lot. The TAC, septic TAC, has a. Supportive rules at times with the county councilors. Mm-hmm. Past fee schedules when there's been increases, we supported that. Your comment about fees that no longer apply, I think we've had some input on that. Mm-hmm. We talk about processes, time frames, mm-hmm. things along that line.
Do you have anything to add to that, Paul?
Well, our group is the store grocery stores and the restaurants and food carts, and you know, these are all food operations that are represented, so therefore we go through certain things a lot of times, things like, for instance, the last time we talked about animals in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And animals in the grocery stores. So we were talking about these policies and procedures and how to handle these things, and that's basically what we go through. You know, at various times there's certain variations and again procedures and things like that. So this is basically, you know.
We meet quarterly.
Yeah.
And the group has the professionals in the community, so it's great. It's just like this council, if we go to our board of the Clark County Councilors or the Board of Health, and we say, we've talked to our TAC, or we've talked to the Public Health Advisory Council about this, and they support it, that is huge for us. And so it's very important that we work with our technical advisory committee so that, and get their input so that we get to a place where they can support what we want to propose.
I work in terms of like grievances and complaints, so people could, just the average restaurant owner or whatever that wasn't on the TAC could go to the council, the TAC council, and say, we have these issues coming up, and then you would be able to take that information to whoever. Is that correct?
To a certain degree.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Not everybody in the outside business participates on the TAC, but any of them are welcome anytime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in the past, on some occasions, we also have reviewed, like for instance, when there's the state codes have changed and adjusted, well then we will go over, you know, certain things and see how it's applicable here in Clark County.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes we've had little subcommittees of 3-4 people working on an issue to bring back to the TAC.
And then like when we do code review, that probably goes to the TAC for their input.
Thank you.
And we're actually scheduling our so part of the struggle we have this year, or this budget cycle, is the budget cycle has been greatly condensed. So we're going from the budget process we'd always done before to program-based or priority-based budgeting. But because of the change in county manager and that position having to fill, we kind of have one foot in each process, which has resulted in a very compressed process. And so we need to get our tax involved, we need to talk with tax, but at the same time, you know, the county is saying we want to meet with you on Monday. So it's going to be a little bit of a, is that a fair statement, Jeff? It's going to be a little bit of a juggling act here. Jeff, we anticipate that he will be fully bald by October. Or he might rip my hair out.
We do have a pool going, so.
So then we take those different models, those different scenarios, and the one-on-ones, what we'll try to do is strategically let them know why, how the different scenarios will impact. Jeff is going to talk a little bit more about the budget, but there's a lot of considerations this round, not just what's happening in our department, but what's happening throughout the county. And so then, once we go through that, the fee service table will go to, is it go to board first, Jeff?
So the fee, it's up to them, really. They will ultimately be approved by the Board of Health, hopefully in November. How, between now and then, after the one-on-ones and one-on-twos, in the past, they've actually asked for a work session before the Board of Health approval. So I would anticipate a work session, but I'm not, I couldn't tell you for sure.
But at some point, they'll vote and there'll be an ordinance, right?
November, typically at Board of Health.
So that is a quick and dirty history of Vermont public health fees, or what makes them up. So Jeff, do you want to talk about?
So what will the fees change in November? Or are you proposing fee changes?
Yes, there's going to have to be some fee changes. We had.
But it won't be based on this data at this point in time. You should only have 6 months. I mean, that's going to be.
Right, so we're using our previous data. So if in the past we said it takes an hour and a half to do this particular activity, we're keeping it an hour and a half until we get another couple years of data in there.
What I've noticed about the budget years ago, it was like 20% fee support, environmental health, and 80% general fund. And just this time, it just kind of got it to where it's flip-flopped.
Yeah, and I think we also went several years without any fee increases, and so it's I feel like we've gotten a little bit behind on that.
If you really want to talk about years ago, it used to be supported by the driver's license fees also, which state got rid of that.
Yeah.
And so therefore it put a big hole in the budget.
Yeah.
Motor tax.
Yeah.
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 Motor vehicle excise tax was a big fine. Yeah.
Well, an example, a septic fee in the mid-70s was $20 for a site evaluation. Now it's $381.
Yeah.
There's been a little inflation.
So yeah.
If I could just add that I really appreciated the way that some of the fees are structured. And we had an episode in the Vancouver Downtown Association where we had a very young entrepreneur who's running something called the Night Market Vancouver. And she had some food vendors in there who got busted for a violation. And I reached out to Dr. Melnick, who got me in touch with the environmental health folks, and Long Vu came up to talk to him. And, you know, the way that the fees are structured is that it incentivizes people to come to public health first. Come talk to us first. If you can come and talk to us about what you want to do, about the service you want to offer, about the food you want to serve, it's so much cheaper that way. And they really, this young entrepreneur and her businesses really appreciated that, that feedback, and really helped them kind of structure to the point that it helped some of these folks decide how serious they were about being in business. Because it doesn't, make any sense if you want to be a one time in a night market to spend $250 versus if you want to be there for the whole year, $160 really wasn't that much. So I appreciate the way these fees are structured to really incentivize coming to you first to get information. So I think that's well done.
You know, the other thing that the team does, which is really great, is they really are partners to our businesses, and especially those new businesses like you're talking about. So if somebody is wanting to start a new restaurant, for instance, they can come in and they can sit down with our subject matter experts, and they will walk them through. They will look at their menus. They will walk them through about what their kitchen setup needs to look like. They've even helped them in some instances where some people were going to buy some really expensive equipment that, in fact, they didn't need. So we've really been able to partner with folks to really set things up. So out of the gate, they are ready to go. They're not going to have violations because they're set up properly. And that's part of that, you know, it's part of the fee, but it's also part of the greater good. And certainly that, and developing that relationship with our restaurant partners is really critical out of the gate as well. So it's really, they're really amazing. When I went through this as a trainee myself, I had an opportunity to go through this, and I was required to put together a new restaurant. And so my restaurant was, I think it was like Noodles and Stoodles. It was an Asian German fusion restaurant. And I found venues and I did all this stuff, and it was an amazing process. And so just from me going through it as a layperson, I can imagine how very, very important it was, or very helpful it was to go through it as a professional. So I just wanted to give them kudos because they do some really amazing work.
And the shocker to me was one of the biggest public health food challenges is people sell tamales on Facebook.
I see them on Facebook Marketplace.
All the time. And you can't determine how safe these are. How are they prepared? Where are they prepared? And yet people are selling them at public venues. And I think this department does a great job of ensuring public health through chasing down some of these vendors and finding out what's going on. So well done.
But how are people directed to the group of folks that can sit down with them and talk to them about how to structure their restaurant or what equipment to buy or whatever? I mean, these people had to get a ticket or whatever.
It was a lot softer than that. I mean, it was called to their attention that this is what you want to do, this is the process you need to follow. And when they saw the big picture, I think there were a lot of people, there were a lot of aha moments. And they were approached with great courtesy and professionalism, and it was received that way. So. What I saw was a concerted effort by this department to reach out to young entrepreneurs who want to sell food, and here's how you do it safely and professionally. So
I think they find out a lot of times too when they go get a business license or they get a building permit or a fire marshal approval.
Mm-hmm. But is that something that's on like the website or?
Yeah.
Cool.
Or if they try to get a food handler's card, then they're like, "Oh, well, did you do all these other things?" You need to call the group. So are there any, you had mentioned, Janice, that there are some fees that you just know are out of sync. Are you addressing some of those? And
yes.
Like what would be an example of one that's really out of sync with what the too much or too little?
You mean related to the
daily time
activity data?
Huh?
You mean
certain fees that, like, they might look at volume and say, gosh, we didn't do this work at all in the last year. That's probably not something we need on our fee schedule. And they might see it, say, this, I'm just making this up, but like, let's say this type of restaurant that has different fee schedules, now that we're looking at the data, it takes them the exact amount of time to do that. Let's merge those two fees, just to keep the fee schedule from getting too complex. Is that kind of what you were asking about?
Yeah, but then again, I mean, are there any fees right now that would, because we want to get all of the more reliable data, until we get that, are there some that just based on experience that you know are too high or too low that you're going to take
a
look at?
Not right now, and that's what happened when we put that DTA data in there. You know, it might say that, in the summer, our food safety folks are super busy because they have to inspect all those street fairs,
any kind of temp event, Vancouver Market, all those things, and they're out there a lot and on weekends, they were only collecting data on how long that takes from July on, which missed a big piece of it. And so when they looked at the numbers, I can't remember what it was, but they looked at it and they said, we just know from doing the work that that isn't accurate. So okay. We're going to stay with the number that was already there. So I wouldn't say anything that's in there now is out of whack. I think we're looking to really refine it.
I'd also say when that data, when that hourly data is updated, it will not affect the collective fees at that program level. Because as we update one to take more time for and one to take less time, the overall revenue that will generate through the fees won't change. All the fees will sort of shift slightly.
I think our concern for the private sector on the fees, that it's fee for service, that we're not being charged excessive, you know, that's real critical. To us in the second program.
Yeah, you mean for your consumers, your clients.
Well, I guess that, but the more reliable this data is, and you're able to assure, like the folks on that TAC that you know that Mark works with, that yeah, we've done this, and this is how much it costs to do this.
Our intention was to start that module sooner. We didn't get it actually ready to go until last summer, like Janice was saying. We were hoping to have more data.
Well, I think it's still seasonal, like in the septic program, winter's a little bit slower. Right. Or the swimming pool program, if you look at the first quarter of the year, you probably got almost zero coming in.
Yeah.
So you really, in my opinion, need at least a year, even 2-3 years, because of what the economy's doing, too.
Yeah, seasonality, economy. And one thing Jeff was explaining to us the other day that I didn't realize too is the economy impacts some of our programs more than others. So some of our environmental public health programs are really tied to development, others not as much. Those that are tied to development seem to be more.
Well, even like the septic planning issues. The septics are limited in the urban area, they're expanding the urban boundary out. Some of the rural ordinances are tougher now, so you know many factors involved.
When we're doing fees, it'll be again, it'll be in 2 years, and we'll have 2.5 years of data. So I'm really, really confident that we'll have better data. That's just not better, just more data.
More reliable.
So the reason we're doing one-on-ones with the counselors around fees on Monday is our decision packages, which basically is what we submit to request changes to our budget. It's all due June 8th, which is about 8 weeks sooner than normal, sooner than prior budgets. And until those fees, until we have some idea what the counselors are going to approve around fees, we really can't finish our budget work. We don't know what their decision on fees will leave us with. Deficit or surplus, whatever the case may be, what our budget situation will actually look like. So how the budget process worked, where we're at right now, is we've completed our what's called baseline. We've worked on reallocating our baseline budget. We looked at our needs around the department. We've got some positions that we're trying to add. We have a bottom line budget numbers. We should have a decision on fees soon. Again, everything's due to be submitted June 8th. The process from that point forward, the council will meet with elected officials and the county manager in late August, early September. The department requests are published October 1st, that's the scheduled date. And actually, the public hearing when we will be able to attend is actually Tuesday, December 4th in the evening, which Lydia announced, or Adrian announced, will be a fact meeting. So we might need to look at that. So by law, the counselors have to approve a balanced budget the first full week of December. They're going to have electeds testify on Monday the 3rd, and then public testimony is the 4th and the 5th, Tuesday and Wednesday. Typically, they will approve a budget by that Wednesday night. I've seen them go on to Thursday. I've seen them go on to Friday. But that's pretty rare. So we'll have a balanced budget approved that week.
So Jeff, we went over this environmental public health fees. What percentage of the budget is that EPH fees? I can't recall from your presentation. I mean, just roughly, what percent would it, could it, the range that we're looking at?
The range?
Of the full budget that we're getting from fees.
You mean not just EPH budget, but the whole department budget?
No, the fees, okay. The fees.
The department budget.
I think she means just the environmental public.
Just environmental health. It's, yeah. It's a majority.
What's it's like, it's around 80%, I think.
Wow. It's a lot of environmental public health those fees. A very huge portion.
What about the percentage of the total department budget? Not just in...
I want to say it's about 30%.
Yeah, it's a big, so yeah. I can see why it's a big variable then in terms of how much, what they're going to be.
Yeah. I would say fees are most critical in this budget that I've ever seen, ever.
Well, and I think part of what's happening right now, I think it's been in the paper too, is the county's facing a huge general fund shortfall.
Yeah, multi-million dollars.
Yeah. And so they're looking for wherever they can free up general fund too. So they are talking about, okay, where can you guys give up some general fund? And in theory, they're supposed to tell us where they might want to make cuts, but they might, we don't know, they could tell us they want to go away from that greater good model.
I had to kind of a larger context. I was invited to sit in on a meeting with Governor Inslee yesterday, and part of his interest was in talking about the replacement of the Interstate Bridge, but the other issue that he slapped down on the table in front of us was, what a remarkable world we live in to be the most prosperous state in the Union, with one with the most economic activity going on, and yet, without spending one additional dollar in the general fund budget in the state of Washington, next year, they're going into a $2 billion deficit. And the reason is that in the state of Washington, our entire tax system is built on a retail sales tax that does not address the reality of an internet-based economy. So it is a real irony, it's a shocking irony, but he literally put his fist down on the table and said, you guys need to realize how serious this problem is. So on one hand, I want to say this is ridiculous that you have to deal with this, but the reality of the way that our taxation and income for public services is set up, it's going to happen.
We've dealt with budget deficits in public health, for years and years and years and years. It's just the nature of being in this business. What makes this year more difficult is the county also is having a difficult budget. We can't rely on them to be a fallback. Not that we have been able to do much in the past, to be honest. When we joined the county, we had around 176 FTE staff. If you don't include the Salt Whisker that we just brought on, we're still at around 81. We're actually well below half of the size we were. And some of that was we chose to spin out our clinical services and some of our WIC program, for example. So some of those decisions, though, were based on budget. We had shortfalls so large, we looked at what services could we spin out to a partner in the community to make sure that service is still here. We're no longer at a point where there are services we have that we can spin out. These services are just going to go away. So we're at a tipping point, basically.
We have, in my neighborhood, such an influx of new residents. And I'm just curious as to why isn't that somehow promoting more revenue? I mean, I understand the internet
property taxes got limited in growth by 1%. And there was, I want to say, 5 out of 6 years that the prior Board of County Commissioners chose to not take advantage of that tax increase. That's... A 1% right now would be $500,000 per year, every year. So the collective of that 5 or 6 years not taking advantage of that, that's millions of mm-hmm. dollars. And it's compounding. So property taxes, though, can only grow by 1% plus any additional building. So the new houses going in, that will actually add to our tax rolls. So it's just not enough.
That's less than inflation.
Yes.
Because of the Iman tax law, the Iman tax rollback, local revenue grow at a rate that is less than inflation.
Yeah.
So okay. Every year you're paying more for health health insurance for your employees, or retirement, or fuel, or anything else, tax revenues cannot grow by more than 1%.
Yeah, and that's probably, it puts pressure on us with our fees. We're going to be promoting, bringing forward fees that are probably higher growth than we have in the past, for reasons like that. You know, we're limited in revenue. The county and local governments are pretty strapped.
Do you think the county council will look at new general fund revenues? Because I know there's a lot on the table for them. That doesn't seem like a group that would be interested in that.
I do think that, Alan, I would rather say this than me, or I'm not even sure if he's going to slap me for saying it. I think there's some decisions they've made in the past that they'll be looking at and may change their mind to generate additional revenue.
One of the principles that they're looking at, and we're working with them in this budget, is to maximize revenue sources. So places where you can bill, for example, like providing services that you can bill for, maximize that. Fees are another thing. If we can, you know, collect, so basically try to do whatever we can to bring in revenue. So that'll enter into this fee discussion that we'll be having with them. The general fund just keeps, it's on a downward trajectory in the long run.
So are we not generating tax dollars or revenue or whatever from this huge marijuana? I don't know. Seems like we should have lots of money.
Let me answer that. So it's been up before the board. So the board right now has the council, I should say, I should call them the board. The council has gone on record as saying we're not going to have marijuana in the unincorporated areas. So the only marijuana retail is in a couple of the cities, I think Vancouver and Battleground. So they're collecting the tax revenue from marijuana retail. Our council has decided not to, because there's no marijuana retail in the unincorporated area, there's no revenue for the county from that. I believe they may be revisiting it at some point. That being said, it's not like that there's a golden rainbow pot there or something. It'll bring some revenue in, but it's not going to be, I heard it might be a few $100,000 by the end.
I've heard about $380,000, and we're talking about deficits in the millions.
So I mean, every little bit helps, so to speak, but it depends on whether they allow it in the unincorporated areas, and the revenue would be limited. You know, when people move in, they require services. You know, the more people move into the county, the more, you know, the more people are at risk for communicable disease, for example. So they do bring in taxes, but they also, that means more services as well, so.
Well, you think about every time you know, in our part of the state, as Steve knows, you know, and our businesses know, you know, this whole issue of being a border state with Oregon. Every time you go to Oregon to buy something, you are hurting our economy here by not paying.
Being a border county has its challenges around retail, you know, sales tax. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, it's a regressive tax, but it really hurts our community especially.
So we're the fifth most populous county and we generate the 10th most sales tax revenue.
Say that one more time.
We're number 5 in size and 10 in sales tax revenue.
Because of the Oregon thing.
What do they call it?
Leakage. The only way local general purpose local governments in Washington can keep pace with expenditure growth is the sales tax. Property tax is not going to cut it. You can't grow your way to it.
That's right.
Unless you land a fab. You know, if you can get a chip fab in your community, that'll keep you humming for a while. That's why the general purpose governments are always talking about economic development, because we want development that doesn't require a lot of services but pays a lot of property taxes. So we like high value commercial and industrial projects.
So one other thing that happens when annexation happens, another thing that's coming to the county general fund, so when Vancouver Mall gets annexed into the city, that goes off the tax rolls for the county. So there's a lot of things that affected county general fund.
We had a contract with the City of Vancouver Police for a records program that they are canceling. That's $1.5 million, I believe. There's up the mall area being annexed. There's several things that are definitely hitting us.
And then, of course, there was that settlement. There was a lawsuit involving the sheriff's office, a jail, I believe, and it was $6 million. That's affected as well. So there's a lot of pressures on it.
Income tax, is that what you talked about, or turning in? Because I think it's a whole other
ball. It's the other problem with sales tax, by the way, it's very volatile. So if the economy goes down the tubes, that drops like a rock as well. So just when you need the money with a sales tax, it's gone. Income tax here?
It's brought up every legislative session.
Brought up, it's been brought up for years.
It's unconstitutional, right? So, in this state.
Well, I mean, that's why it's Oregon.
So Oregon won't do a sales tax, and Washington won't do an income tax.
So we have to, you know, something's got to give. So if we're having leakage or whatever it's called. Losing of people on the train deals. If you work in Washington and you live in Oregon, you don't have to pay state taxes.
Or if you live in Washington and think you're still an Oregonian, you know, that's a
don't register
license
plates.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I can go California, 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 Oregon, Oregon, California in my neighborhood, and I hate that. But that's not public health, is it?
Maybe 150% cost recovery for restaurants. Maybe that's.
Yeah, right, right, sure.
You give that, Paul?
Your contribution to it.
Well, I will let you know that in the years that I've been here, that I have never refused an increase in fees, okay? But don't take that for granted. No, I've never. I've always been supportive. You know, it's just like for bonds and things like that, I'm always so supportive of school bonds. I always think that if they're transparent and they put it where they're supposed to be, that's the whole key. You have to have transparency.
One way I look at this, you know, around the greater good and all that, you remember a couple of years ago we had an outbreak, salmonella at on the border restaurant, which no longer, we had 120 cases. Think about the amount of money that went into that investigation. Uh-huh. Sometimes, you know, the greater good, I look at it as similar to insurance in a way in terms of public safety. You may be a good driver, but your premium, part of the premium you pay is going to help to cover the folks who are not such good drivers as well. And that's what the greater good is. You know, every restaurant pays a certain fee, but the greater good piece is even if you're doing everything you're supposed to be doing, there could still be an outbreak associated with your restaurant. Let's say one of your source foods is your source is a problem. And the bottom line is there's a cost that the fee itself doesn't really cover, unfortunately.
Exactly. Yeah.
So hopefully, I mean, it feels like we still have a lot of unknowns right now, but hopefully next month we'll have a little bit more information and we can talk about what we might be asking of the council in terms of supporting us and our budget.
I think what the septic industry would like to see is sometimes we've been presented the fees like just a week or two before, so earlier we get them.
It's going to be rough this year with timing and the accelerated.
Highly, highly compressed process.
I'm meeting with Joe Harmon, Joe Laxon, our Consumer Protection Program Manager, and Chuck Harmon, our Natural Resource Protection, I think tomorrow or Thursday, to start talking about how are we gonna do this? How are we gonna time it and do
this? I think the earlier we get on, the more we understand them, the more we can support it, and we can deflect a lot of opposition. You know, our builders that talk to us or whatever.
Yeah.
More information we have early makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And I don't remember, Jeff, was there much change with septic? I don't remember.
Not last year.
Okay, I don't want you to answer that because you made a face, so thank you.
He answered.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for your patience.
Thank you. Is there any council member updates?
I have something. I don't have the location right now, but I spoke with Roxanne and she said I should go ahead and look to so that you have the information that it will be happening. And as soon as I find out the location, I will make sure I get it to Lydia or Roxanne, one to get out to you. On June the 8th, there will be a forum sponsored by a Division of Behavioral Health and Recovery, a part of DSHS. So people in the community can come and talk about problems that they've been having with the way that we are integrating into managed care versus the way it was before. Hopefully everyone is finding it working versus not working. I think it's going fairly well, fairly smooth. I haven't seen a whole lot of increase in complaints and grievances. But on June 8th, if anybody's having any problem with their medical service delivery, particularly behavioral health, I will let you know where that will be, and you can come in and say whatever, or give us kudos or whatever. And kudos to Remy for twice being nominated for the award.
So I have an announcement. On Monday, June 18th, the ACEs Action Alliance, and of course with Cindy Myers coordinating with our whole council and a lot of partners, we are starting a book club, a community book club, and the book is Becoming Ms. Burton, and it's going to be at the Cascade Park Community Library from 6 to 8, and it's going to be, we're starting this quarterly book club, so hopefully you'll all come. I haven't read the book, but it's on my reading list right now, so hope everybody can read the book and then join us at the book club. Cindy's working with, you know, trying to get some additional copies for people of the book. So
we read that we have a book club with Counselor Bolt, and we read that was
that's
the
right.
That
that's how it came up.
It
yeah, a
great book.
Was it Becoming Mrs.
Burton? Ms. Burton?
Ms. Burton.
Actually,
you said one more time.
Becoming Ms. Burton.
B-U-R-T-O-N.
Thank you.
Actually, okay. Sister Andrea from Peace Health recommended the book, and she recommended it to Counselor Bold, and it's a fantastic book. So.
What was the date, Joe?
Monday, June 18th.
6 to 8.
6 to 8, Cascade Park Community Library, and there'll be some more press coming out about it. And then I just wanted a personal thing. I am reading the book, The Deepest Well, by Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris, one of the leading spokespeople now in the country on adverse childhood experiences. And when I'm done, if anybody, I'm listening, I have the book on tape, if anybody would like to listen to it, let me know, because I'd like to keep this and pass it around. It's an excellent book. It's, you know, there are parts of, you know, when she did her TED Talk, and of course she's received all kinds of a recognition for her becoming sort of a national figurehead for the work on ACEs. So I'm halfway through the book right now. If somebody would like to read it next, it's on a CD. Let me know and I'll pass it on.
What is the book called?
It's called The Deepest Well.
Who's the author again?
Dr. Nadine Burke-Harris. And she's a pediatrician. She has a practice down in Bayview in the San Francisco area, very low income area, but she's able to take all the science and make it so that a lay person can understand. So she's able to take the science, you know, she's been, the part I've been reading about epigenetics, I mean, she makes it so that a non-healthcare professional can understand that brain science. So I encourage you to read that book as well, but if you'd like to borrow this when I'm done, I'll loan it around.
The few meetings ago, there was an interest in building a stronger connection with some of the other programs in the county, one of which being the Youth Commission. Mm-hmm. And then I took that to the Youth Commission and mentioned, you know, was there interest in maybe a joint meeting or this kind of thing? And there was. At this point in the year, it's probably a little late for us to try anything, especially with the Youth Commission's schedule, because we have a big event in June that we're kind of preparing for right now. So at this point, it would be too late for this year, but next year, we're definitely interested in putting something together with the two groups.
Excellent.
Great. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Would we want to do any planning this year for next year? Or do you have
possibly,
a time? So maybe we can work on timing for that. We can build that into our schedule this year if that would be.
All right, good job, guys. Is there a motion? I think I can just actually enter an item of the motion. I have to do my work. We're done.
Okay.